You're listening to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John McCarthy has witnessed the best that the UFC had to offer.
That is it! Game, set, match! We have a new champion!
Your backstage pass to the world of mixed martial arts and combat sports. Only on the Ignotainment Media Network.
Let's get it on!
Hey everyone, welcome to Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and me, Sean Wheelock. Every week on this podcast, John and I give you an inside look at MMA and combat sports, always separating fact from fiction. On this week's program, we'll look at the evolution of weight classes in MMA, which John played a huge part in, and we'll discuss if the creation of a cruiserweight division would be a good thing for the sport. Plus, we'll be joined by Victor Ortiz, the former WBC welterweight world champion, to talk about the new Premier Boxing Champion series, his rapidly emerging acting career, as well as his views on MMA and his friendship with Ronda Rousey. And as we do on every episode of Let's Get It On, John will answer your questions. So ask away via email, info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. That's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Remember that you can download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app and subscribe. And you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. So, John, last month in Bellator, it was a fight that you refereed and I commentated. King Mo defeated Czech Congo by split decision in a unique heavyweight fight. Now, I say unique because King Mo weighed 217 pounds and Congo weighed 239 pounds. It's, of course, becoming increasingly rare in high-level MMA where you have two fighters in a heavyweight bout, both coming in under 245 pounds. So, John, as we open this episode of Let's Get It On, let's open with a proposal. How about creating a new cruiserweight division set for 230 pounds, then with the creation of the new cruiserweight division, take the cap off of the heavyweight division, forget about 265 pounds as a maximum, open it up like it's still done in a lot of Eastern Europe and Asian MMA?
You know, it's something that's happened in the past. We've even talked about it. If you go back and you look at Mo Lal against Czech Congo in that fight, you know, what people aren't thinking, if Mo Lal weighed in at, you know, 217 pounds, he's not really weighing even 217 pounds. He's in the back drinking out of, you know, drinking a bottle of water. He's doing everything opposite of what every fighter does, which in a lot of ways I'm happy to see. I'm glad to see him doing those things because he's completely hydrated. He's feeling good, but he's going to be fighting a bigger guy. And, you know, and we've had this in the past. You know, when you saw Randy Couture was the champion and fought Brock Lesnar, you know, Randy walking around weight is 215 to 20 pounds. Brock Lesnar's is 285, 290 pounds. You know, and he cuts down to 265 to weigh in, and then he's back up. You know, everyone gets this idea that, oh, it's okay if heavyweights are just huge. Oh, there's, you know, if you're 210 pounds, you can fight a 310 pound guy. The concept behind this is crazy when you think about it. It's like saying, you know what? I think that I am going to put Jose Aldo against John Jones. That's what you're doing. Now, no one's going to make that fight. Okay, although Jose Aldo is an incredible fighter, who thinks he's going to beat John Jones? You know, it just the size and the weight difference and the length and everything with it, you look and you go, this is not reasonable. And that's why we have athletic commissions, and that's why we have these, you know, weigh-ins and the weight classes that we have, is we have to put people in a place where at least they're competing with someone that is close to their size. Now, when we do the weigh-ins and then, you know, afterwards people are going to weigh different things, and that's all things for the future that we need to discuss and talk about and change. But we absolutely need to look at that heavyweight class going from 206 pounds basically up to 265. You know, you're talking about that huge 60-pound weight difference in that class. It's too much. We really do need to take and put in something in between to help guys that are, you know, I don't want guys that are 230 pounds trying to cut down to 205. It's unhealthy. It's bad for them. So let's give them a weight class where they're not doing that. Now, you're always going to get people saying, well, then the bigger guy will cut down and stuff. That's a possibility. But this whole weight issue has come about before. Back in, yeah, somewhere around 2000 and 2008, I was approached by people with the, you know, Association of Boxing Commissions, and I suggested there would be a one weight class change, and that would be let's put in a cruiserweight in between the light heavyweight and the heavyweight. And we didn't even talk about taking the cap off of the heavyweight. It was, you know, let's put it in at 230 pounds. So you have light heavyweight up to 205. You have from 205 to 230, which is, you know, a 25 pound jump. And then from 230 to 265, which is a 35 pound jump, that's your heavyweight class. And it's to, you know, try to get it towards at least closer for some of these guys, so they're not either trying to drop down so much that they're dropping a ton of weight to get to light heavyweight. And, you know, it just seemed more reasonable. It ended up changing. There was some people, Armando Garcia being, you know, the guy that was running California at the time, he put in all of these weight classes in it. And he changed it to like 14 different weight classes. And then I got, you know, it was my name that was associated with it. So I got the brunt of it. Like, I wanted to change all those weight classes and, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. What happened to the past is the past. But I really like the weight classes that we have in MMA. I like the fact that we have weight classes that are similar to what was established in boxing in the heyday when, you know, Sugar Ray Robinson was fighting as a welterweight and then would move up to a middleweight and then would move up from the middleweight to the light heavyweight. There was huge jumps there. What we have in boxing now is we have so many weight classes with this 4 pound difference between champions. That's just too close. And it's just, it's put in there to create champions. I like the fact that we have a good separation in our weight classes, but I would love to see a separation in the heavyweights.
John, you make a great point on boxing, because old school boxing, right? It was 135, 147, 160, 175. And then you start getting in the junior category. So a junior middleweight's now 154. A junior welterweight is 140. You go to the lower weight classes, and literally, as you said, you're talking about, not exaggerating, you're talking about a 4 pound swing, and that's determining something in a weight class. So obviously in MMA, you go from 135, 145, 155, 170, 185, 205, and then there's the jump. And we get indoctrinated, to those of us who are listening to this podcast in North America, the cap at 265. But when I was in Pride, there was no cap. When I was in M1 doing a lot of fights around the world outside of the US and Canada, there was no cap. You still see the no cap. So if you put in the cruiserweight, which I'm in favor of personally at 230, this is why I say take the cap off of 265. Clearly, MMA history has shown us there is a point of diminishing returns. If you look at some really heavy fighters, Eric Butterbean Esch, Henry Miller, Zulazinho, Emmanuel Yarbrough, Aki Bono, all the way back to Taylor Tooley at the first UFC, if you're 400 pounds, it doesn't mean that that's going to give you an advantage over a 260-pound fighter. So there's those diminishing returns. That's why I say uncap it. So don't make somebody like Brock Lesnar cut weight, because if he's sitting at around 285, 290, that's fine. It's not as though a 400-pound guy is likely going to come in and beat him, or at least dominate.
Yeah, exactly. And really, you know, when you're looking at it, I don't want Brock Lesnar cutting weight. I want Brock Lesnar, if he's going to come back to fighting, I want him being comfortable. I want him not dehydrating himself and saying, look at me, I'm a 280-pound guy, and that's what I'm going to fight at. Okay, you don't have to make it to that 265-pound limit. There is no limit for you. And, you know, this is all about, there is that point of it starts to work backwards, because, you know, everyone looks at heavyweights and goes, well, he's so much bigger. Yeah, but it's also, you have to carry that weight. And when you're moving that weight as the heavyweight, it takes energy to move that much weight. And then the moving of that much weight tends to drain your gas tank. And so there's a plus side and there's a minus side, and you've got to balance it out. And so to be that really big guy does not always give you that advantage that people are looking at, like, oh, this is going to be a thing. Now, there can be some guy that comes out of nowhere somewhere along the way, you know, that is 6'9" and, you know, 370 pounds, like a Bob Sapp, that is an incredible, you know, athlete that has great grappling skills and great striking skills. And we're going to go, uh-oh, he's just too big for everybody. And it's a possibility. You know, you can never look at the future and not, you know, say that that can't happen. It can happen. But the reality of what we've seen with who are the best heavyweight fighters they're normally in the range of somewhere in the 230 to 250 pound range. You know, we did start to get that little period with the UFC where we had, you know, the Shane Carwins, who was cutting weight to get to 265, the Brock Lesnar cutting weight to get to 265. You've got Bigfoot Silva. He cuts weight to get to 265. But most of them are not cutting weight, and that's a good thing. That's something we should be happy with. And we really don't want fighters having to cut weight to make it. That class of cruiserweight in between the light heavyweight and the heavyweight just makes sense as far as keeping guys that are of the bigger, you know, frame and everything that are having to cut down to get to that light heavyweight to compete. They have a class where they can compete without having to cut weight.
Every week on Let's Get It On, we bring you a poll question. You can cast your vote on our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. So this week's poll question, should there be a cruiserweight division in professional MMA set between the light heavyweight and heavyweight divisions at 230 pounds? Vote yes or no. Again, let us know what you think. Letsgetitonpodcast.com. So, John, you mentioned, yeah, there's the possibility, in theory, you could have someone 6'9", 350 pounds, but professional boxing doesn't and never has capped a heavyweight division. So look at boxing as a guide. The Klitschkos are big, but they're not over 300 pounds.
They're where huge.
Are all the, but they're not over 300 pounds. So where are all the 320 pound world champions in boxing? They don't exist.
They're all playing in the NFL. That's where they are. They're at.
That's exactly right. Because you know what? It's a point of diminishing returns. And I think the cruiserweight, if you just look at the King Mo Czech Congo fight, you know, maybe King Mo says, I don't want to cut to 205 anymore. Although realistically, this stage of his life, that's where he wants to be. It was a unique fight. But let's say King Mo gets to a point. I'm comfortable. I want to fight at about 220. I don't want to cut. Chuck Congo, who came in at 239, clearly with no weight cut, that's not a steep cut to cut 9 pounds. And somebody with Chuck Congo's frame, who clearly can knock out anybody in the world if he lands the right punch, kick, knee, or elbow, would have the opportunity to either fight as a smaller heavyweight or a big cruiserweight. I think that would be very interesting. Now, it does create challenges for mainly the top two organizations. If you look at my Bellator as well as the UFC, now you have to create new title belts. You have to create new weight categories. You have to build those weight divisions up. So logistically, there's probably something at play. And I don't know from a promotional aspect if they would embrace that change or not.
I can't say if they would or not. You know, I know, you know, years ago they didn't want to do that. And it was totally understood when they were approached with all these weight classes. It was completely understandable why they wouldn't want to do that. It was changing some of their fighters' weight categories as far as titles and putting so many in there that, you know, look at, you can only grow so fast. But the UFC, if you look at it, and Bellator, if you look at it, have only done the weight classes that they've wanted to anyways. You know, Bellator still doesn't have a flyweight division.
Right, we don't do 125, you know, absolutely.
We don't have flyweights in Bellator. Okay, great, you don't have to. No one's saying that you have to do this when we're incorporating female divisions into Bellator and the UFC. The UFC has two female divisions. They've got the 135 with Ronda Rousey, and they've got the 115 with Carla Esparza as their champion. And I'm sure that along the way, they'll bring another one. So they're incorporating new weight classes in with women. They could do it, you know, with one weight class with the men. I don't think it would be that big of a thing for them to do. It might change a couple of people that are, you know, in their light heavyweight or in their heavyweight to a different division and stuff. But yeah, you're creating another champion, but they're having to do it in other ways too. So I think that they're, you know, absolutely, you know, it is easy within their realm to be able to accomplish the task. It's a matter of, do they want to?
There is, of course, a super heavyweight division, which is north of 265 pounds. Clearly, the UFC doesn't embrace it. They don't have a super heavyweight champion, nor does Bellator. You know, you throw it out. When was the last time anybody saw a relevant fight? When was the last time anybody saw any fight whatsoever in the super heavyweight division? John, in my career, I've commentated exactly one super heavyweight fight. You just don't see them.
And you know, that's the whole thing. And this is where people are going to sit there and say, but well, what are this, you know, this guy's going to get heavy. This one, what about? Look at, I don't think Bellator, I don't think the UFC. The UFC doesn't bring in people that can't fight. And, you know, when we look at a lot of the super heavyweights, we get a lot of heavy people that their skill levels are just not that good. And so no one really wants to watch them fight. Now, there could be that one person that comes in that has that. you know, I can tell you, you know, there's a boxer out there, you know, and he's fighting, you know, he's training with Buddy McGirt right now, and is he's from China, you know, Tishuan, you know, is his name, and he's a 7 foot one MMA fighter who came to the United States, and they told him, hey, let's put you into boxing because your weight limit, you know, you can't get down. He's 7 foot one and he's got no body fat. He's a big guy and he's weighing 290 some pounds. And they're saying, you know, we can't get you any fights in MMA as, you know, as a super heavyweight, let's put you into boxing. So he's now a boxer. So you could run into those kind of guys, you know, you can have that where that guy does come out that he could be that, you know, big guy, but you know, he, like everyone else, he can be taken down, and I don't care how tall you are. When you're on the ground, you're my height. So it's, everything is relative. I think it's just a matter of time, you know, when, you know, people look at it and start to understand the reasons for doing it. As far as these vast differences in weight, it's not going to change the fights. It's not going to, you know, they're not going to pull in people just because now they're big people. They're only going to pull in talented people that can fight or what people want to see. And those are usually going to be people within the weight limits that we've been seeing.
John, I think the evolution of weight classes in MMA is fascinating, and you were right there a part of it. So just as a bit of historical perspective, so put this in my book that I wrote with Art Davey, Is This Legal? Art gave out a flyer, and it was self-reporting. You wrote down your own weight. That was the joke that Kevin Rozier weighed 265 when Art was convinced he was about 315. But there was no athletic commission. Art didn't even bring a scale to the event. He just wanted them to write it down so he could put it in the program, and it could be announced by Rich Goins on the UFC pay-per-view broadcast for UFC 1. But there were no weight classes. Eventually, as you started refereeing for Art at UFC 2 and moving forward, you and Art came up then with two weight classes, above 200 pounds, under 200. Take the story from there of how you then broke it down, because I know you were really right at the forefront of creating the weight classes that we now use.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, if you look back way back then, as far as what we had, we, you know, the UFC started out, it was, you know, no weight classes, nothing. No, you know, anybody could fight anyone. But we were limiting a lot of really good fighters that were smaller guys into saying, I can't compete against that size of a human being. You know, just doesn't make a difference.
Just to throw in, Hoyler Gracie is a great example. You know, someone who walks around about 145, 150 pounds.
Exactly.
You know, he just wasn't going to go into an early UFC, even though he probably had superior, and you would know this, you rolled with both of them, superior jiu-jitsu to Hoyce Gracie.
Oh yeah. You know, Hoyler was phenomenal, but just, you know, at 140 pounds, you're asking too much for somebody. And so, you know, finally, you know, Art started what we called the Ultimate Alliance is what we use for as a regulatory body. And then we started looking, and then we had our first weight class difference was that 200 pound cut. And there was guys like Jerry Bolander who fought in UFC 8 against Scott Ferozzo. Then that was the David versus Goliath. And Jerry Bolander was weighing about 195 pounds and Scott Ferozzo was about 350, you know, and Jerry wins, you know. And then, you know, he's fighting all these giant guys, and it gets to a point, it's like, you know, we need to do something to create a class. So we ended up coming up with, again, that 200 was the cutoff. If you're a 199 or below, you're in the lightweights, and if you were, you know, 200 above, you were in the heavyweights. And then it moved from there to, we did what we said, okay, we're going to do a lightweight, middleweight, and heavyweight, and we put in the class between 170 and down was lightweight, and then 170 to 200 was the middleweight, and then over that was the heavyweight. And then when things really started to, you know, take place and precedence, we were trying to put in more people, and we wanted to get, you know, more people involved in the fighting and lighter guys. And, you know, close to UFC, you know, 30, when the Fertittas took over, we had the first lightweight at 155 pounds was Jens Pulver, fought for the title against Cal Uno. You know, that was 155 pound. You know, at the time, Pat Miletich was the welterweight. We changed it to welterweight at the 170 pound. And then we, you know, ended up putting in a middleweight at 185. And eventually, when we had the unified rules, we talked about the weights, and that's where we went and justified, you know, what weight classes we were going to do. And they started, you know, looking towards boxing, and we really tried to push it towards old boxing. You know, like I said, in, you know, the 40s and 50s, when we had eight champions, in boxing, and that was it. And we really didn't want to have it where it was muddied. We wanted to have it. It was a clear cut. There was a, if you were going to change a weight class, it was a big change of weight. It was, you know, either 10 pounds, 15 pounds, sometimes 20 pounds of weight. That was the difference, not that real, you know, 4 to 7 pounds that you're getting in boxing today. And, you know, it has worked. It has worked out very well. It's, you know, nothing's perfect, and I'm not saying it's perfect, but the whole point of putting it together was to separate the weight classes enough to where you didn't have the run over of, you got this guy, he's fighting at this weight, and then 4 pounds later he's fighting at this weight, and now 5 pounds later he's fighting at this weight. It just became muddied that way. So when we came up with the weight classes the way they were, the one that was, you know, in question at the time was the big difference between heavyweights at that 205 to 265. But we just looked at the time and said, well, that's just what it is. And, you know, it stayed. Should it be changed? Yeah, I personally think that we need that one in between it.
So, John, with 2 decades hindsight, if you were given the mandate, let's say you and Art Davey are sitting down again.
No one's giving me mandates.
It's 1994, and so you have a blank slate. What do you write up the weight classes as?
Oh, my God. And you know what? I really don't think I'm going to go anything lower than the 125 that we have. I think that would be my lowest. Now, if you go into boxing, you get into the 106s even. You know, you've got the 115s and stuff. But I think the 125 weight class is as low as I would go with the men's. Obviously, women's, you can go lower with the atom weights at 105. I really, the straw weight at 115 you can do. But the men's is going to stay at 125. And I really like the 10-pound at least, the 135 to 145. We do the jump after the lightweights. From the lightweights to the welterweights, we got a 15-pound instead of a 10-pound. I still don't have a problem with that. I really think that, you know what, as you're getting bigger and stuff, there can be that jump. And I like our weight classes all the way up into the heavyweights. The heavyweights is where I see, you know, it's just too big of a gap between the fighters. And, you know, having the super heavyweight, someone say, well, you have super heavyweight. And yes, we do. But we just don't see super heavyweight fighters because we just don't have people of that size that are skilled enough that people really want to watch.
John, last point on this. So to create a cruiserweight division, do you think that the impetus has to come from one of the major organizations, UFC, Bellator, or does it actually come from the Association of Boxing Commissions, or does it come from like a really progressive commissioner like Mike Mazzulli at Mohegan or Andy Foster in California who say, this is what I want to do?
Well, I think that, you know, if you're going to look at, it's going to come from the ABC. The Association of Boxing Commissions is the one that's going to have to come up with the ability to look at and say, this is something that is good for the health and safety of fighters. It's good for a separation of this weight. And, you know, it would take, you know, someone like an Andy Foster, you know, a Mike Mazzulli, a Bob Bennett from Nevada, someone that has, you know, good background in our sport that, and has a commission that's a strong commission that can, you know, start to look at this and say, you know, this is what is good for our athletes. Now, again, there's no promotion, be it, you know, Lion Fights, you know, with Muay Thai or, you know, RFA or Legacy Fights or the UFC or Bellator or any of them that have to follow putting a champion in at that cruiserweight level. The big difference is that if a fighter weighs in at 232 pounds, they're going to be a cruiserweight in that state that has that weight class. And so if you have a 232-pound fighter and then you have, he's fighting a 215-pound fighter, you've got them at two different weight categories. So now it comes at, well, are we going to do this as, this is going to be okay and we're going to do it as a catch weight? Or are we going to say, nope, you're in two different weight classes, we're not going to do the fight? So there's a lot that goes with it. There's a lot to think about. It's not something you just jump in and do. Everyone thinks, oh, it's just simple, do it. It doesn't really work out that way.
Every week here on Let's Get It On, John and I will answer your questions. Email us whatever you would like to ask. And I mean whatever. Bring it on. info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. We just won't answer things we don't want to. info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Just about everything is fair game. Bring on the controversial topics. And of course, as I like to remind you every week, I'm completely obsessed with saying names correctly. So if you have a difficult last name, please include instructions on pronunciation or a difficult first name for that matter. You know, as Sean, I was always seen. Was there a seen wheel locked first day of school in the Midwest? I guess Sean counted as a difficult name with the S-C-A-N spelling. I guess as John McCarthy, you never really had that problem, did you?
No, but those people that were in Kansas obviously went to school, LA Unified School District, because they can't reach Sean.
Seen Wheelock. Yes, that's me. So again, info, email us info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. The first question comes from Joe Daddy 85. And see, you can use a screen name too. It's cool. Joe Daddy 85 asked, John, why don't we see refs in MMA use instant replays like other sports do to get the call right?
That's a good question, but there's really it's very limited on which states allow instant replay and what they allow the instant replay to be used for. Instant replay is allowed in California. It's allowed in Nevada. It's allowed in New Jersey. It's allowed under a little bit different circumstances in each one to a point, but it's really there for if there is a foul that the referee believes there was a foul and has stopped it and wants to go back and view to see exactly how that foul occurred. If they look at it and want to see, did the foul actually hit the opponent the way they thought it did or something like that, they have to actually say, I want to see instant replay on it after they've called time, put the corners, their fighters to the corners and stuff. And they can come out and look at the foul to justify what they're going to do with the call. So yes, there is the ability to do it in a couple of states, but most states don't have that instant replay rule within their legislation. So it's limited where officials can do it.
Here's the obvious thing too. And sometimes I think people don't even consider this because you think from the sport top down. So there are a lot of camera angles, a lot of great replays. If it's a UFC pay-per-view, but John, you work small shows, you work AMI shows in California. There's not even an internet stream. Maybe there's somebody recording on a GoPro in the back or a camera that they bought at Best Buy or Sam's Club. But where does the replay come from on small pro shows, on AMI shows? You just don't have that opportunity. And then would you ask the states to invest into a three-camera setup? That's unrealistic.
Yeah, and again, every state is different. I can tell you in California, when it comes to amateurs, every amateur fight, every amateur event is filmed. You know, when we were putting together the statutes for it, I was one of the dummies doing it, and I mandated that they had to have actual footage that went into an archive for a camo of every fight they had. And part of the reason was, if we want to have instant replay, we have to be able to go to it. Now, every fight, is someone able to pull it up at the time, an official would want it? Can't say it is in some of those shows. When you're looking at instant replay, you're asking the production company. So if it's a Bellator with the production of a Spike TV behind them, or if you're looking at the UFC with the production of the Connells who run that production behind them, yes, you're going to get that. So you can get that instant replay in one of the bigger shows. But most of the time, you're not going to be able to get it in the smaller shows because a lot of them don't have the actual ability to pull something right back up and show the official. So that ability to use the rule, if the commission allows the use of instant replay, sometimes is determined by the level of the show.
Next question, it comes from Natalie Hendrickson, who is 11 years old. Natalie asked, what does it take to become an MMA referee? What steps did you have to take to get to the place you are?
It's a good question, Natalie. And there's a lot behind that. And there's some things that, I'm going to bring out that I think are important for everyone to realize. How I got to where I'm at is different than other people. And that's because I was picked by Jorge and Gracie after UFC 1 to come in and do it based upon him kind of believing that I didn't mind seeing people hurt. So that's not a good qualification. Just putting that out there the way it is.
But let me interrupt. Tell Art Davies' lifeguard chair story, what Art had for you for UFC 2.
Oh, my God. That was, when they asked me, they said, we want you to referee, but we've got it set up. You're not going to be in the cage. you're going to be sitting in this chair that's above the cage. And I go, a chair above the cage? What are you talking about? Yeah, we're going to have a pole. It's kind of like a lifeguard chair. You know how you're sitting up above the pool. And you're going to have this red towel. And if you think that fight needs to be stopped, we'll have you throw the red towel at the fighters and stop. And I go, and you think they're going to stop because of a towel? What if they don't see the towel? We didn't think about that. it just got into this whole thing where eventually the lifeguard stand and the towel went away and we had a referee inside. And after, you know, UFC 2, I can tell you straight out, I told Horian, I'm never doing that again, ever. It was horrible. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. I hated it. You know, I had people inside of a cage that didn't know how to fight in ways that they needed to know. They weren't going to tap out because sometimes they got hurt to the point they couldn't tap out, and their corners were too stupid to throw in a towel to help them. And I was stuck in a position I wasn't supposed to stop it. It was a horrible situation. And that's when things started changing as far as the way we started officiating MMA. And, you know, the term I came up with long ago was, you know, if you cannot intelligently defend yourself, we're going to stop the fight. And I got to start using that in UFC 3 because I had told Horian, I'm not doing that again. It ain't happening. And he allowed me to start having the impact of being able to stop if someone was hurt to the point they could not intelligently defend themselves, I could stop the fight. And so, you know, what people need to realize as far as MMA, what does it take to be an MMA referee? Well, you have to have knowledge of the sport. And when I say knowledge of the sport, you cannot go in and referee MMA fights without understanding exactly what the fighters are doing, what type of setups they're doing. Now, that's both in the stand-up. You'll see the setup of their footwork, of how they're trying to set their opponent up, and that setup of submissions on the ground. I can't tell you how many times I have been in, you know, inside the cage where I have a fighter who is absolutely setting up a beautiful submission. You can see it happening, and the crowd is screaming to have the fight stood up. And because they don't understand what's going on. So as the referee, you have to understand that, because if you are someone that is uneducated in it, you don't understand it. You're going to stand that fight up. You're going to take someone's ability to end the fight right now away, and you're going to be unfair to the fighters. Our job is to be fair. Number one is safety of the fighters. Number two is in the enforcement of the rules. And number three is the controlling of the fight, how you actually control what's going on and how fair you are to all the fighters. So you have to know the game, and you have to know everything that they're doing. You have to know exactly what those holds are, how they should be placed on, how they should be defended. Because if you don't know that, you're going to be behind and you can make a mistake. So your knowledge is important. The one thing I want everyone to think about is, if you want to be a referee in the NFL, do you think you just write a letter to the NFL and say, hey, you know, I've been watching for 30 years and I think I'd be freaking really good at this? Because that's what people do with MMA and boxing. It's unbelievable. They go and they get this idea that because they've been a fan and they've watched that they can do something. It's not what you think. You're not watching a fight the way a fan watches the fight. So when I say, you know, how long do you think it takes someone in the NFL? It takes them about 15 years. They go through Pop Warner football. They go into middle school football, into high school football, into junior college football. Maybe they make it into Division I, Division II. And then as they're going, they get into maybe Division I, and they can make it to the NFL. So that is about a 15-year process. Same with Major League Baseball. Well, what we have with boxing and MMA is we get people that go to a course. I teach courses. I teach how to be an MMA official. And so you go through a 3-day course, and now you've got this piece of paper that says, John McCarthy says I passed the class. Now, to pass my class, you got to do really good. But that piece of paper is saying that you are ready to start your journey in MMA, meaning you need to start working with amateur fighters. You need to start working with amateur organizations as an inspector and doing the job as an inspector, as a judge, and as a referee. So you get the full concept of what an official is supposed to do. And after so many years of making mistakes in the lower levels, hopefully you get the chance to be that official in a UFC or Bellator, but that should be years down the road.
Keep your questions coming. info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Still to come on this week's program, we will be joined by our special guest, Victor Ortiz, the former WBC welterweight world champion who now has a really good acting career going for him. We'll talk PBC boxing, MMA, and more with Victor Ortiz. Stay with us, everyone. Alongside Big John McCarthy, I'm Sean Wheelock. You have found us. This is Let's Get It On. It's the book that Wrestling Observer calls a must-read for any MMA fan. Jonathan Snowden of Bleacher Report describes as riveting and amazing, and thefightnerd.com says nothing is held back. Pick this book up right away. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it, written by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by John McCarthy, is now available to listeners of this podcast at the special price of $12.48. That's far less than you'll pay for the book on Amazon and half price of what you'll pay in store at Barnes & Noble. Buy it directly from the publisher now online at ascendbooks.com and enter the promo code LEGAL50. That's ASCENDbooks.com, promo code LEGAL50. Learn the true story of how the UFC came into existence in the book that Randy Couture describes as honest, shocking, and enthralling, and that has a rating of 4.9 out of 5 stars from Amazon Reader Reviews. Is This Legal? The inside story of the first UFC from the man who created it by UFC founder Art Davey and me, Sean Wheelock, with the foreword by Big John McCarthy. Available now online at ascendbooks.com for just $12.48 when you use the promo code LEGAL50.
Hey, this is the Ocho Man. If you're enjoying Let's Get It On, you'll really love my show, Behind the 8-Ball. We talk about everything happening in the world, from the NFL, hot chicks, even our political views. Always, it's a great show. We give you sports picks absolutely free. Find my show at www.ochoman.com. Give us a shot and enjoy the rest of the show. Let's get it on.
Now, back to Let's Get It On, with your hosts, Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock.
Big John and I are now very pleased to be joined by Victor Ortiz, the former WBC welterweight world champion, cast member on Dancing with the Stars, film actor, and my fellow Kansan. Hey, Victor, thanks for being on Let's Get It On.
Kansan, I love it.
You're a big deal out of Kansas, man. You know, Tommy Morrison fought out of Kansas City, but he was from Oklahoma. Just talk about your rise coming out of almost obscurity in Western Kansas and pro debuting at 17 and getting all the way to a world title, because it's not the conventional path for a top level boxer.
Yeah, you know, it's been an interesting path, really. But for whatever reason, I've been very, very fortunate. I have also opened the doors for a lot of the boxers from that area, you know. I pro debuted at 17 years old, and at the time there was a little stable, but with that stable grew some people too. So, I've done very well. I've just take it from the man who raised me pretty much, which is Bucky Avila, Mr. Ignacio Avila. He always told me to respect one, respect all, and just work hard and work hard to achieve your dream. So that's all I've really been doing. And one thing has led to the other. I've had some big highs. I've had some low lows. And I don't know. I just keep positive, and something positive always turns out in the end.
You know, Victor, you have been boxing and in and out of boxing really for, you know, your whole career. You're seen a lot, and then all of a sudden you're not. You were last seen in what, December 13th in Vegas with a 3-round KO victory. Who is going to be your next opponent?
At this point in time, there's been quite a bit of gossip of a lot of different fighters. Take, for instance, the winner out of Berto and Lopez, the fight that's coming up. I would like to destroy both, but
Both of them, right?
I did.
Because you took the title from Berto.
Yes, sir, I did.
And then Josecito was the one where you ended up with a broken jaw. You fought how many rounds with a broken jaw?
You got that. I fought 5 rounds of holding my jaw with my left hand, and yet I was completely criticized by the world. I thought it was funny, and him too. You know, that's why I have no respect for a person like that. I think when you're a world champion and a champ like myself gives you an opportunity, but yet one-sidedly wrecked your world until that one Hail Mary landed. I don't see any kind of integrity in that.
So. Victor, last week on Let's Get It On, John and I talked a lot about Al Heyman's Premier Boxing Champions. The inaugural edition, it was on NBC, drew 3.4 million viewers in the U.S. You're going to be fighting under Al Heyman's banner. How much excitement is there as a professional boxer that you get this opportunity with Premier Boxing Champions?
No, it's great. You know, our stable is pretty amazing. I'm actually just excited to be back in the ring, period. So it doesn't matter if it's under anybody else. I mean, the thing is, though, Al Heyman has been great to me in my career. So I have nothing but the best things to say about Al and the Watson team. So, you know, I'm just very fortunate.
What is it that makes it, because every boxer is now coming out saying, you know what, Al Heyman treats me great. Sam Watson is great to me. All these different things. And these are boxers, and you've been with other promoters. What's the difference between the promoters and Al Heyman, and what is it that's making Al Heyman stand out, you know, as the guy that everyone wants to be fighting for?
Well, I think it's pretty simple there, in the senses of he's an intelligent person, but he's also the guy who's getting you the paydays that you deserve, that you're supposed to be getting. I mean, take for instance, you do the history of a lot of promoters and whatnot throughout the years. Everybody, if you're gonna get paid a few million, you end up getting paid $5,000, and they're like, "Oh yeah, that's all you made." It's like, really? Is that right? So it's kind of like Al Heyman makes it justified, you know, you're paying and that's that.
So really what you're saying is Al Heyman is honest with you. He has integrity and he gives you what you're supposed to get.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all I've experienced so far. So,
Victor, so aside from still at the height of your boxing career, you're transitioning into acting. Last summer, you were in The Expendables 3. You have a new film coming up. It's going to be released in July. It's called Southpaw. You star alongside John. Listen to this. This puts your little Friends episode to shame, man. Jake Gyllenhaal, Forrest Whitaker, Rachel McAdams. We won't even talk about when I was in The Game of Their Lives. I didn't go too well for me. This is a big deal. But how did you then get into acting? What was the break in The Expendables 3? Did you hire an agent? Were you actively looking for gigs, or did somebody see something in you in a fight?
No. Like I said, something always happens when something tragic takes place. For example, I broke my jaw about two and a half years ago. After I broke my jaw, I could have sat around, you know, wallowed out. Oh my God, it's a poor me. And I didn't. I said, you know what? I'm going to go do Dancing with the Stars. Everybody made fun of me, but I was doing that for.
I was one of the ones making fun of you. Just so you know.
Yeah, John, all of your friends are on this show. Couture, Victor, what's going on, man?
Yeah, Chuck. I mean, dude, you know what? My friends have rhythm. That's all I want to say.
Although I have two left feet, I think I'll agree. No, so from there, I was told by Sylvester Stallone that his wife was a big fan of the show. Now, I think his wife had him watch me a few times. The next thing you know, Gersh Agency had signed me, which is a acting agency, and then they offered me to be on Expendables 3, and I kind of laughed like, yeah, right, me on Expendables, are you kidding me? That's dream come true, but like, that won't be happening. And then I get an offer to go shoot the, you know, to go fight a co-main event for Canelo versus Mayweather, and then I just said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I refuse to fight under Canelo. Unless he wants to fight me, then that's a different thing. So after that, I went off and I got the whole promotion pretty angry at me because I said no. And I went and shot Expendables 3. And then from Expendables 3, I guess Sylvester Stallone vouched for me to Antoine Fuqua over if he can act or not. And then Sylvester Stallone said that I could to Antoine Fuqua. Next thing you know, I'm shooting Southpaw. And it's been a crazy roller coaster. And then after the movies were shot, I said, I want to go back to fighting. My agency was like, Vic, you don't need to fight anymore. I said, I know that, but I got to be world champion again. So they're like, Vic, seriously. I'm like, no, I'm going to be world champ again. So then I come back, and then I had a little hiccup, and then everybody counted me out once again. And then I came back, and I said, you know what? I'm going to fight again. They're like, oh, dude, you should not. You shouldn't. You should retire. I'm like, I'm 27. Why would I retire? So I come back and then I score a knockout, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh God, so when are you fighting again? Oh yeah, you know, you need to get in the ring again, you know, soon. And I'm like, anyways, I'll get back in the ring when I want. So at this point in time, I just have a couple other projects I'm working on. So And of course, Celebrity Sweat with all the guys and, you know, Big John and Eric the Trainer, and just having a good time.
You seem to be going all over the place, but let me ask you this. When you worked with the Expendables, you had both Ronda Rousey, mm-hmm. MMA, I mean, she is the thing in the females, and you had Randy Couture. Did you get to work out with him? Did you do anything with him while you were there? And did you learn anything from him?
Randy had me on this very like hard workout sessions thing. It was crazy.
Oh, it had to be his workout where you're going from one exercise to another and doing just
rotation. But it was a lot of weights. Yeah. Oh my goodness, I don't really do weights, man. But not like that. But he was killing me. And then of course, the Ronda Rousey, I did. I helped her with stand up. I don't do well on the floor. So I was like, we can't go to the floor. So she got me in an arm bar one time, and I was like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. You're going to break my arm. I need my limbs.
Well, you were at 184 watching Ronda. Yeah. Did you go there because it was Ronda?
Yeah, of course. I went to support Ronda, and one of my buddies went with me, Chris Beal. He's also from the UFC thing, and it was a good time.
Chris Beal, he's out of right here in Ventura.
Yes, sir. Knuckleheads.
Knuckleheads. A knucklehead working out at Knuckleheads.
Yes, sir.
That's beautiful. What did you think of her fight?
There's like, that's all I could say was, wow. It was like, bing, over.
Bing, over. It was that stupid armbar thing again, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was crazy, man. I'm telling you, those are dangerous.
Victor, when you look at MMA, is there anyone with striking? And obviously, it's so different. But do you look at anyone with striking, even if they're more of a kickboxing or a Muay Thai base, and think, wow, this is pretty impressive? Or does the striking just seem so different from what you do, the way you stand, the way you throw, the way you position your hips and your shoulders?
No, I said this almost a week ago. I was hanging out with Cub Swanson. And they asked me a similar question, but I just simply put it like this. I said, look, anyone who tries to compare boxing and MMA or UFC are just, they need to really do their homework and study a lot of things before they can make a comment like that, because they're two different worlds, 100%. I mean, yeah, maybe the work ethic and the discipline, it's the same. But other than that, when it comes to the striking, the jiu-jitsu, the I don't know, all kinds of names for different moves, I don't know. But all that stuff compared to boxing is just two different worlds, really. Like, I don't see a boxer above a UFC fighter or a UFC above a boxer. I think it's mutual respect coming from a person like me. But then again, I speak for myself, not for all.
I agree with you. And John, I'm guessing you feel the same. After Randy Couture beat James Toney in the UFC, at the press conference afterwards, a reporter asked Couture, why don't you box him? And Couture said, because he would knock me out in one round. It's almost like when people would say, why don't Roger Federer and Tiger Woods compete? In what? In golf, Tiger Woods wins, and tennis, Roger Federer wins. And that's the way I look at it. Hopefully we're moving past the idea, well, who's going to win, a boxer versus an MMA fighter? Well, what sport? And in their sport, they're going to win. Obviously, no one in MMA boxes and punches the way you do, Vic. But then as you talked about, you're not slapping on kimuras. You're not rolling around on a mat or throwing kicks or locking on a Thai plum in your daily training.
Yeah, you're right. I totally agree.
You know, you look at people when they get into this whole thing of trying to cross the sports. The reason they're trying to cross, you know, MMA and boxing is because they're both fighting sports. But, you know, and so that's exactly what Vic is saying. We're talking, they're two different sports. You can go back to Randy Couture against James Toney. And you look at that, you know, James was the reason that fight took place. James was, you know, going after Dana saying, hey, I want to fight. I want to do this. And James had an incredible boxing career. But I think James knew that he was, you know, he's at the end of his boxing career and looked at it like, hey, if I can land a punch on one of these guys, I know I can knock him out. And he's right. You know, and you look at what Randy did. Randy brought out a takedown that we don't even teach in MMA. It's old wrestling. You know, a low single where you're grabbing the back of the foot with that wrestling shoe. It has friction. I'm driving my shoulder into the knee and bringing the guy down. We don't do it in MMA because it can lead to you being in a really bad position if the guy understands anything about countering it. But when Randy did it, he does it on James. James has no idea what's happening. He ends up on the ground. And once he's on the ground, he was, you know, a fish out of water. He didn't know how to handle what's going on. And, you know, that's not his element. And so to sit here and to try to cross them over is silly, to say, well, who would win? If you take an MMA fighter and you put him in a boxing match, guess what? Most likely, if it's two top level guys, the boxer's going to win. He's going to knock the MMA guy out, or he's going to at least take the decision and take the decision. You know, if it's a 10 round fight, he's going to get 100 on his scorecard on one end. He's going to win just about every round because that's his world. That's what he works. He works at one thing, boxing, movement of his feet, use of his hands. He doesn't worry about ground positioning. He doesn't worry about takedowns. He doesn't worry about any of that stuff. It is two different sports. You put a boxer in the MMA, they have more of a chance of winning by landing that one good shot. But once that one shot is missed and you have that clinch, the boxer's in trouble. So you can't compare the two.
I agree.
Victor, last week on Let's Get It On, John and I were talking about a big difference between professional boxing and professional MMA is the record obsession in pro boxing. And here's a couple of examples. So we've been talking about our buddy Randy Couture. Randy Couture, no matter who you are, if you're a fan of the sport, you're going to say, and rightly so, he's one of the all-time greats. 19-11. Now, Vic, you know, if your record were 19-11, I'm probably refereeing you at a Ramada Inn ballroom somewhere in Dodge City, Kansas. Rich Clemente, who had a nice run in the UFC, fought for us in Bellator. He started his pro MMA career at 4-6. Good luck digging out of that hole in pro boxing. You started at 24-1-1, and it's almost like you had to have that type of start. Did you feel that overwhelming pressure that, wow, if I lose 3 out of my first 10 fights, this is going to be all over before it gets started?
No, I never really thought about that. And to tell you the truth, I can't even tell you what my record is right now. I never really paid attention to the record.
But other people are. No doubt, though. Other people are.
At the end of the day, though, there's one thing that I've learned throughout the years is I know everyone has their opinion. I know everyone has their two cents, but I ultimately don't really pay attention to that. I don't feel it's relevant to me. Anybody's thoughts about me, it doesn't matter to me. Prime example, I was out at the Watermark. It's a little place down here in downtown Ventura. It's owned by a great friend of mine, Mark Hartley, right? And I'm sitting there, and this older gentleman says to me, "Hey, Victor, how are you?" I said, "I'm doing well, sir." He says, "When are you going to get back in the ring?" I said, "I was actually just in the ring about 6 weeks ago. He says, "Yeah, but again." And I said, "Did you catch my last fight?" He says, "No." I said, "Well, then why do you need to see me again?" And he says, "Well, you know, I just want to see that you still got it." I said, "Huh, that's cool. Well, I'm pretty sure you'll be hearing about it sooner or later." He says, "Yeah." He says, "You need to make people like me feel like you still have it." And I'm like, "With all due respect, sir, I don't really care what you have to say about me." He says, "Well, you should." I said, "Well, I really don't." He says, "No, you really should. Do you know that I can root for you?" I said, "Let me break it down. Or you can root against me, right?" I said, "Wow. Yes, sir. I get that completely." I said, "So what?" He says, "So, wow, you're pretty rude." I said, no, I'm not rude. I'm just trying to enjoy my evening here at the Watermark. And then somebody knows nothing about my sport is trying to put me down because I don't make you feel special, right?" So he says, "Well, like I said, I could root. Let me cut you off again. You could root for me. You could root against me. Let me make this very simple for you in short, sir, with all due respect. Root against me so that every time you root against me and you put some money on the other guy, you're going to lose. So that way you could hate me even more. Anyways, you have yourself a great day, sir. See ya." Well, I got to go. Bye. So, yeah, people got their opinion and have their opinion, and they're going to continue to have their opinion as I have mine.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I don't understand what it is. And maybe it's, you know, the size thing or something like that. But I see people, you know, come up towards you and some of them act like they want to take you on.
They do.
And it's like, are you kidding me? Do you realize what you're doing? Are you that stupid? But they get that idea that, you know what, they have to act tough with you. And the one thing that I see out of you that I love about you, Victor, is it's one of the things, and I want everyone to understand this. 27 years old. Well, I'll tell you, when I was 27 years old, I walked around with a scowl on my face and I wanted everyone to know, don't fuck with me. That was really what I was thinking. You know what? You want to do something? I'll do it. Don't even think about it. You're nothing like that. You are so kind to everyone. Yeah. You treat everyone with respect. It's just like what you're telling the story. Yes, sir. No, sir. You say that to everyone. You say it to me, which only makes me feel old and I don't like it. But you know what? You absolutely disarm people with how kind you are. and how sincere you are. And I've watched you sitting on a plane for the entire plane ride talking to people that are sitting there who become huge fans of Victor Ortiz because, you know what, they realize, oh, my God, he's so nice.
Well, that's John, great. He's
one of the things that I see.
He's from Kansas, John, right?
It has nothing to do with Kansas, baby.
Victor, from what I know of your reputation, though, you've always had that quiet confidence about you, even when you were starting in this business, that you didn't feel like you had to go and talk or try to prove people right or wrong. You were just going to go in and give your best performance and then let the results speak for themselves.
Absolutely. That's pretty much how I've always carried myself in boxing. I mean, at the end of the day, you look even like, okay, I've had some fallouts. You know, I've definitely fell a few times. And in those falls, people can hate me because of why? Because I lost. But at the end of the day, you can't really sit there and criticize and hate me because I talk bad about somebody or oh, he put him down completely, this and that. It's like, you know what? I just say, hey, tomorrow's another day.
Vic, do you see a difference with the culture of MMA from an outsider's perspective, someone who used to broadcast and I've refereed pro boxing and now fully immersed in MMA as a commentator? I see a big difference in the cultures on the inside and knowing Ronda Rousey, knowing Randy Couture. Do you see a stark contrast in the cultures between pro boxing and pro MMA when you're a fighter?
You know what? I like the thing about MMA where everyone, okay, when you're going to fight, you're going to fight. You hate each other. But after that, it's mutual respect, and it's awesome in the MMA world, in UFC. In boxing, it's like one's yapping, the other one's yapping, okay. And that's how it ends, and it's even more yapping, and it's kind of like, all right, whatever.
You don't see as many hugs after a fight in boxing as you do in MMA.
No.
Hold it. Not as many you hardly see ever.
I was racking my brain. I was trying to think of the last time I saw two high-level boxers hug afterwards. I'm not sure if I ever have. Yeah. Is it the animosity in the gym? Is it just the culture of the sport? What do you think that comes from?
There's one important thing about my gym here in Ventura, California, Knuckleheads Boxing Gym, and even now in Indio, California, with Coach Joel Diaz and the Diaz team. If you're not a kind individual, and if you're gonna come into any of those gyms with an ego, then first off, they're gonna put you in the ring so you can spar and get your ass whooped, and then you're out of the gym. We just don't need that. But that I think we're just one of the few in boxing that do that, because that there's no ego. There's a no ego sign on my wall at the gym. Like, dude, you got an ego? Please don't come in.
Yeah. And then my gym, I have a giant board where it says check your ego at the door. And the whole reason is everyone walks into gyms thinking I'm a tough guy. That's great. You know what? Awesome that you're tough. But the true tough people don't have to prove it. You know, the true tough people, and people know that they're tough, and you know, we don't want people going in there trying to hurt other people. We want people going in trying to learn, trying to get better at what they do. And if you want to be that professional and make money at fighting, then step in the ring and show what you have from there. But here's my question. I got to know. We have probably the biggest fight in the last 50 years coming up between now. Floyd Mayweather signed to fight Manny Pacquiao, if it really comes about, which I hope it does. You had the experience. You've never fought Pacquiao, but you did fight Floyd Mayweather.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you're a southpaw. Mayweather likes to use a shoulder roll. That's what he does for his defense a lot. Pacquiao being a southpaw, that shoulder roll does not work in the same way as it does against a standard stance fighter. How do you see that fight going?
You know, everyone's counting Manny Pacquiao. I think that's the wrong thing to do. Manny's a little smaller, but Manny throws from different angles. He's in and out, and he throws 100 punches at a time. Mayweather's just taking his time, picking his shots, but it's going to be a little hard for a guy that fast to come in and out from the opposite angles, throwing how he does. He throws a looping lefts. I mean, I think it's going to be an exciting fight, that's for sure. But the thing is that gets me is I know for a fact, I mean, not to sound bad, but Mayweather can't crack an egg. And I know for a fact that Manny Pacquiao can, I mean, he can put some people down.
He can crack an egg.
He can crack maybe two.
Two or three at a time.
Victor, is there a concern, though, that maybe this fight is happening 3 or 4 years too late, that the relevancy or the luster is gone?
That's what I was thinking. It's probably a little too late, but I don't know. Everybody, like I said, oh, because of Manny's last few performances or fights or whatever, but I don't know. I think they're both about the same. I mean, maybe Mayweather hasn't been through about as many wars because he usually wears his track shoes, but other than that, you know, I guess some wear and tear can be part of the situation, but I don't see Manny coming down at all in his high right now.
I'm being honest, you know, well, let's see, Floyd's 38 years old, Manny's 36 years old. And, you know, off of Manny's last two performances, you know, he beat up on, you know, LeGarry Bad. Chris, you know, went in there. Chris is a good boxer. He was just outclassed by him. And before that, he beat up on Rios. Mm-hmm. You know, and he made Rios look just absolutely slow. I mean, slow, to where Rios wasn't even, you know, Brandon wasn't even able to get in position to hit him.
Nope.
It was a one-sided, you know, just a beatdown. And you look and you go, well, you know, yeah, he did get knocked out, you know, in his one fight. If you want to go back to, you know, the quads with the fights that he had in with Marcos. But I mean, I think it doesn't matter. It's happening now compared to 2 years ago. This is an incredibly compelling fight. Both guys can win the fight. Both guys have the elements that make them special in what they do. But it's going to be which guy can make the other guy fight the way they want him to fight. Exactly. Is going to be the difference in the fight.
Yeah, I agree with you. Big time.
Victor, it sounds like you're leaning towards Pacquiao. Obviously, we're a long way from the fight, but if you had to make a prediction right now, would you go with Pac-Man?
Yep, I always go for the underdog. I've always been the underdog, so yes, sir. Manny Pacquiao.
Victor, it's been great having you on Let's Get It On. Before you go, I want to ask you, who's your next fight? Who? You can stay and hang out with McCarthy all day. It's cool.
I'm just kidding.
But he's going to.
We're
going to
go.
He's coming back to Kansas. We need you back in Kansas, man.
Boy, I tell you what.
Who do you want? Who's your next fight? Who do you want to call out? Who do you want to see happen? You'll be fighting in a big fight, probably a main event on a PBC show. Who would you like to see in the ring?
You know,
Hold on. It doesn't matter who he wants. I'm cutting in here. Okay. I know that, you know what? I watched a fight with Mile High Mike Alvarado against Brandon Rios.
Well, that's what I was getting to.
He called you out. This is a guy that you kind of, you know, were around in Kansas and then coming out to California, you were around him. You guys have done a lot together. I think that's a phenomenal fight. I think it's two contrasting styles. You both fight completely differently, but Brandon has proved to be, he is one rock solid, tough son of a bitch. Mm-hmm. And you have proved to be a technically incredible boxer that moves in and out and gives shots without taking them most of the time. I think it's a compelling fight. I want to see you fight Brandon Rios because I think that's the best fight there is.
You know, I agree.
Ooh, look at that. I'm good.
Because the simple sense of this, yeah, we can go back to my personal record of like the guys I've been defeated against. But if you actually pay attention, in none of the fights I've been defeated in, I've gotten whipped. I didn't get whipped. I just, something happened. I got caught. Something tragic took place. It is what it is. It was over. Now, Rios, he talks a lot about me. Very, very bad. And I think it's kind of funny because if it weren't for me, he would have never came out to California. I brought him to Oxnard. I introduced him to Camp Garcia. I got him his contract through Top Rank. I got him his everything from Cameron Duncan to Robert Garcia. So I'll definitely give Rios a little reminder of who Daddy is.
Great stuff, Victor. Thanks again for being on the program, man. We'd love to get you out to a Bellator, and hopefully I'll see you in Kansas, if not sooner, at a Bellator event.
Sounds great, brother.
Thanks, Victor.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Really great stuff from Victor Ortiz. You'll see him fighting upcoming in PBC Boxing. You'll also see him this summer in the film Southpaw alongside Jake Gyllenhaal, Forrest Whitaker, and Rachel McAdams. And you can follow Victor Ortiz on Twitter at Vicious Ortiz. John McCarthy and I are back with you next week for an all-new episode of Let's Get It On, first available on Friday. Download and subscribe to our podcast on the iTunes Store. For Android, download the Stitcher app, and you can go straight to our website, letsgetitonpodcast.com. You can also find us on social media, facebook.com/letsgetitonpodcast, and on Twitter, @podcastmma for this show, and for us personally, @JohnMcCarthyMMA and @SeanWheelock. To ask us a question, make a comment, or inquire about becoming a sponsor of Let's Get It On, email us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. Again, that's info@letsgetitonpodcast.com. For our excellent guest, Victor Ortiz, John McCarthy, and our producer, Chris Lakin, I'm Sean Wheelock. Thanks for listening. This has been a presentation of Ignotainment Media Network, online at ignotainment.com.
Let's Get It On with Big John McCarthy and Sean Wheelock, only on the Ignotainment Media Network. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in the comments section of the iTunes podcast store. If you have questions, comments, or are interested in sponsoring the show, contact us at info@letsgetitonpodcast.com or check out our additional lineup of podcasts, including Ocho Man, Behind the 8-Ball, The Whiskey Philosopher, and Youth Baseball Talk at ignotainment.com.